This is Phil Farron, and I am driving home, and it is warm today. This is what, episode 171, I think, according to the little calendar on my phone, or the little temperature on my phone. It is 98 degrees out. So, yeah, it's a little warm. The air conditioner's coming on. The air conditioner's coming on. Fairly full. I will talk loud. Because it's warm. My steering wheel is warm enough that I'm holding it and then not holding it. But we'll see if we can get it. My day is completely messed up today. I don't know what day it is. I almost got in my car and drove home without even recording this. Obviously, this is the 4th of July week. 4th of July was yesterday. It is now July the 5th. My major client, everybody was off yesterday, and I was too. Had a lovely 4th of July. But what that means is when it falls in the middle of the week like that, a lot of people just go ahead and take vacation either for the first 2 days or for the last 2 days of the week because they can take a couple of days vacation and then they have Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, you know, almost a full week with just 2 days of vacation. Or they take the last two, obviously have Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So anyways, because of that, the projects that I had in queue that we were waiting on approvals for, that meant that the people that we needed to be doing approvals and starting the approval processes, they were all on vacation. So I came in on Monday and realized, okay, they're all going to be on vacation. I'm going home to write. So that I went home and wrote all day Monday, came back in, same thing Tuesday, went home, wrote all my day Tuesday, was off on Wednesday. I'm back in today. In my brain, I know it's Thursday, but everything is telling me it's Monday. And while I usually don't come in on Fridays, I am going to go ahead and come in tomorrow. We've got some meetings, and I'll probably work for the majority of the day just to try to get caught up on some hours, because I think after the meeting we have tomorrow morning, we should be rocking. We should be ready to go. And it's funny because as I was leaving, I just realized this now, as I was leaving my client, I was thinking, oh yeah, if I come in tomorrow, then they're all going to have a chapel service in the morning, so I won't actually be able to get to them until 9 o'clock. But it's Friday, not Tuesday, so everything's going to be fine. I am so confused. Anyways, I did remember, I should say I got a little ping and a whisper as I was opening my trunk that, oh, right, I got to do a podcast. Anyways, so today. Oh, well, as far as other news, Clara, my granddaughter, is just getting cuter and cuter. She's actually starting to talk now, and I went back. Sunday, we ate at my mom and dad's house, and Clara was in the back climbing on the chair and climbing down off the chair and climbing on the chair and climbing down off the chair. And so I went back to see how she was doing, and she was sitting in the chair, and I walked up, and she looked up at me, and she went, "Hi, puppy." and I said, "Hi, Clara, how are you?" And so we just had a nice little conversation. She's starting to string words together now and make sentences, and it really is an amazing thing to watch all over again, the human mind and the development of the human mind and the development of her own little personality and her own wants and desires. And you know, it's very interesting. It's just fun to watch. Anyways, the writing is going well. I'm actually plowing right along on this new book. It's snapping together. I thought it was only going to be 80 pages, but it's not going to be 80 pages. Because I'm already up to page 70, and I'm almost halfway. So it doesn't really need to be 160 pages, because there ain't that much stuff happening in this book compared to the last one. But I'm hoping it'll land somewhere around 120, 140, somewhere in there. We'll see. We'll see. But things are falling together. There's a few things that I have to tweak and move around, and I got to find a nice end. I think I have the end, but I think I do. It is the end of the series, so it has to be satisfying, but this book is more like an epilogue than it is like a big ending, because the big ending was the Easter week, and so everything is, that's the high point of the arc for the entire series, and so now we're just sort of sliding towards home with this, and so the drama, per se, is over, and we're just sort of picking up the pieces now and looking at the after effects, but we'll see. I mean, Jesus has brought me this far with this series. He's not going to let me down. Now, we'll come up with something that's satisfying and interesting for people to read, and then we'll be done. Anyways, last week, I had talked about Brené Brown's TED Talk on the power of vulnerability. And I mentioned I would probably talk this week about her subsequent talk called Listening to Shame. She's quite fun. She's funny. And I have what she has, I find what she has to say fascinating, because she's nibbling all around the edges of flesh and spirit, particularly flesh, but she doesn't call it flesh. She calls it shame, which is fine. It's fine for a starting point. That's a good starting point. But the problem is if you keep identifying it as emotion or as a mindset, then you really don't get to the real lever that helps you abandon that voice and the things that that voice says to you. If you look at it as a separate voice within you and a separate entity within you that is trying to put you on a path to destruction, it's still you, it's a part of you, but it's not you in a way. I think it gives you a much better leverage on saying, yeah, I'm not doing that. I'm not listening to you. But that's neither here nor there. The fact of the matter is she has a lot of really interesting things to say about shame, and so I thought I would pass them along and then say, yeah, here's one point that, see, if we just tweak this a little bit. Anyways, one of the things that was fun about this talk is that she talked about the after effects of the last talk, and I mentioned that briefly last week. She said that she got home from her last TED talk and she woke up the morning after with one of the worst vulnerability hangovers of her life. She said she didn't leave the house for 3 days because she was so aghast at what she had just done. Called up a friend, met her for lunch. Her friend took one look at her and said, you look like blank. In other words, you look terrible. She said, thanks. She said, okay, what's going on? And she said, well, I just told 500 people I became a researcher to avoid vulnerability. And then when vulnerability emerged from my data as absolutely essential to wholehearted living, I told these 500 people that I had a breakdown. She said, I had a slide, and it said, breakdown. She said, I can't figure out why this was a good idea to say this. And she said, her friend said, well, I watched your talk, and at first it didn't seem like you, but I thought it was a good talk. It was good. She told her friend, you don't understand. They're putting it on YouTube. We're not just going to be talking about 500 people. We're going to be talking about 600 or 700 people. And of course, it wasn't just 600 or 700 people. It turned into more. And she said, I had no contingency plan for it being 4 million people. She said, I had prophesied that my life would be over. And she said, her life has profoundly changed. And she's learned some things since that experience. She said, the first thing she's learned is that vulnerability is not weakness, which is absolutely true. And when I hear her talk about vulnerability, what I hear her talk about is people who are willing to embrace the voice of their spirit when their spirit is saying, try, you can do it, be courageous, try. For me, that's the voice of the spirit. She calls that vulnerability. She says that she defines vulnerability as emotional risk, exposure, and uncertainty. See, that's very similar to what I call spirit. Because with spirit, the spirit is going to challenge you to take risks. The spirit is going to challenge you to say, everything's going to be okay. You can chance it. You can walk into uncertainty because he has already been there and he's walking with you. And just as a sidebar here, this is why I think it's easier to embrace what a Brené Brown would call vulnerability. I just waved at somebody and I have no idea who they are. I'm trying to see. Yeah, no idea. Okay. We came up to a stoplight. Somebody stuck out his hand and waved. I waved back. This is why I think it's more difficult when Brené Brown is just talking about vulnerability and she defines it as emotional risk, exposure, and uncertainty. There's no foundation under that for, well, why is that something that I want? She will say, because that's the only way to live a wholehearted life. Okay, well, maybe a wholehearted life isn't all it's cracked up to be. Okay, which might be a response. But if instead you say, you need to live a life where you're listening to the Spirit, trusting the Spirit, trusting that when the Spirit says, yeah, let's try this, what's really going on is that's God saying, come on, you can try it. It'll be good. Everything will be okay. Risk it. Don't be concerned about the uncertainty because ultimately there is no uncertainty. I'm already there. Everything will be okay. But anyway, so that's how she defines vulnerability. And she says that she's come to the conclusion that vulnerability is our most accurate measurement of courage. That to be vulnerable, to let ourselves be seen, is to be honest. And I think that's really good. Now, one of the things that is interesting then is she, from that then, derived that the TED Talks were absolutely great because you had people who were coming there and talking about their creativity, talking about their innovation. She said, but the one thing that we miss in all of that in the TED Talks is that these people are also willing to come and say, yeah, I messed up here, I didn't do this right, I failed here. She said, everybody who comes to TED tells you not only about all the great things, she said, but yeah, this was a lot of work. And she said, they're all vulnerable and they tell you that it wasn't perfect the first time. So she thinks that's really great. And I think that's really great. What was interesting, though, is that in the process of talking about all of this vulnerability, she said, I learned also that we have to talk about shame. She said, with shame, she said after she had gone through, she did have another cute story. let me skip back and tell you about this little cute story too. She had another really cute story about what happened after it got seen 4 million times. She said, this is what my life is like. She said, I'm walking through a grocery store or a store of some kind, and I hear a woman shout behind me, Vulnerability Ted! Vulnerability Ted! And she said, I just keep walking because I don't want to have this conversation. I just want to get my stuff and go, Vulnerability Ted! And she said, this woman comes up to me, and she said, of course we're in Texas, so she can't talk softly. She's shouting out, Vulnerability Ted! And she said, this woman says how great it was, and how she got the book, and how, you know, it was blah, 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 blah. And she said, people are looking at me, and she's talking about how great it was that you talked about your breakdown. And she said, people are taking their kids and moving them off to the side to get them away from me. And she said, I look at this woman, and I say, yeah, it was a freaking spiritual awakening. And she said, the woman looks back at me and she hits me on the arm and she says, I know. She said, we watched your TED Talk in my book club. She said, we read your book. We renamed ourselves the Breakdown Babes. She said, our tagline is, we're falling apart and it feels fantastic. And Brené Brown said, you can only imagine what it's like for me at faculty meetings. So that's fun. That's fun. So she said, you know, once I became Vulnerability Ted, like the action figure, she said, I wanted to not talk about shame anymore. I just wanted to talk about vulnerability. She said, but we have an old saying in Texas that you got to dance with the one who brung you. And she said, so I realized that I would have never learned about vulnerability if I hadn't been doing the studies on shame. And she said, if you're really going to help people embrace vulnerability, she said, you really do have to talk about shame. And so this is where her conversation then turned. And in my terminology, she started talking about flesh, how flesh keeps you from listening to spirit. She calls flesh shame. Okay, that's fine. And she said, because you can't really talk about the important things about, like, race without talking about shame. Or any of the other big things. She said, because shame is that thing that will tell you that you can't embrace vulnerability because of this, that, and the other. It will tell you that you can't really get up in front of all these people because of this, that, and the other. And she said, there's a quote that really saved her in the last year when she was going through all this vulnerability stuff and wrestling with the shame of telling everybody that she had had a breakdown. And it's a great quote. It's from Teddy Roosevelt. And the quote is this. I don't think I just did this right. I was supposed to go get my mail and I didn't do it. The quote was this. It is not the critic who counts. It is not the man who sits and points out how the doer of deeds could have done things better, and how he falls and stumbles. The credit goes to the man in the arena whose face is marred with dust and blood and sweat. But when he's in the arena, at best he wins, and at worst he loses. But when he fails, when he loses, he does so daringly, or greatly. So, you know, great quote. Oh, my buddy is driving up. I don't know if we're going to have a little talk or not. No, we're just waving. I am going to get my mail. Looks like he's talking on the phone. One moment. Getting the mail. Yada, 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 yada. Okay. Anyway, so that's a great quote. So that's what she used to encourage herself when she was wrestling with this shame of all this vulnerability stuff. Let me just get moved in here a little bit so I can get back to my notes. Okay. Okay, so then she started talking about shame. And when she started talking about shame, I was going, yeah, flash, 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 flash. She says, shame drives two big tapes within us. You can tell she's from my generation, because she wouldn't say tapes if she wasn't from my generation. She would say something like waveforms or something like that. But anyway, she said it drives two big tapes within us. And those two big tapes are never good enough. And if you can talk it out of that one, who do you think you are? This is her definition. Shame is a focus on self. Guilt is a focus on behavior. Shame is, I am bad. Guilt is, I did something bad. She said, how many of you, if you did something that was hurtful to me, would be willing to say, I'm sorry, I've made a mistake? How many of you would be willing to say that? Guilt says, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. Shame says, I'm sorry, I am a mistake. Okay, well, that's an interesting correlation. She said in her research, shame is highly, highly correlated with addiction, depression, violence, aggression, bullying, suicide, eating disorders. She said, here's what you need to know even more. Guilt is inversely correlated with those things. The ability to hold something that we've done or failed to do against who we want to be is incredibly adaptive. It's uncomfortable, but it's adaptive. In other words, what we're saying is that if you believe that you are a good person and you do something that's wrong, you will go take care of it. So she's saying the reason that guilt does not drive people to take care of something is if they are also filled with shame at the same time. And that's okay, that's true. But if you're filled with shame and you feel like, oh, you know, I'm just stupid, I can't believe I did that, then when you do those things, you attribute it to the fact, well, that's just the way I am and there's nothing I can do about it. Anyways, the other thing that she said that was interesting is that her studies have turned up the fact, truthfully, that shame is organized by gender. My ears always perk up because I'm always interested to know the difference between genders as to how things are played out. And in her estimation, shame with respect to gender and the female gender is best illustrated by the Angelou commercial that says, I can put out the wash on the line, pack the lunches, hand out the kisses, and be at work 5 to 9. I can bring home the bacon, fry it up in the pan, and never let you forget you're a man. She said that's kind of this ideal that women can never live up to, and so they're filled with shame because they can't live up to that ideal. Now, just put that away. We'll get back to that in a minute. She said, for men, it's different. And she said, at first, she didn't even talk to men about shame until one time she was doing a book signing. And she said, a man had 3 books for his daughters and for his wife. And he said, I love what you have to say about shame. I'm curious why you didn't mention men. She said, and I said, I don't study men. And he said, well, that's convenient. And she said, why? He said, because you say to reach out, to tell our story, be vulnerable. But you see those books you just signed for my wife and my 3 daughters? He said, my wife and 3 daughters would rather me die on top of my white horse than watch me fall down. When men reach out and be vulnerable, we get the blank kick beat out of us, and don't tell it's from the guys and the coaches and our dads, because the women in my life are harder on me than anyone else. Now, okay, that's all really interesting, and we'll come back to it in a minute. So what she's saying is
that when you look at women, their shame is wrapped up in the quote-unquote female norms. That the norms for a female, when you ask what are the norms for females in this country, the top answers you get are nice, thin, modest, and use all available resources on appearance. And when you ask what are the norms are for men, the answers that you get are always show emotional control, work is first, pursue status, and violence. Now, she says the way to combat shame is empathy. Because shame grows in secrecy and silence and judgment. But if you put empathy in there, okay, that you can get rid of shame. She also had a closing thought before I get back to those things. She says, so I'll leave you with this thought. If we're going to find our way back to each other, vulnerability is going to be that path. And I know it's seductive to stand outside the arena and think because I did it, I think I did it my whole life, and think to myself, I'm going to go in there and kick some blank when I get bulletproof and when I'm perfect. And that is seductive, but the truth never happens. Even if you got as perfect as you could and as bulletproof as you could possibly muster, when you got in there, that's not what we want to see. We want to see you go in. We want to be with you and across from you. And we just want for ourselves and the people we care about and the people to work with to dare greatly. Okay. I don't think that's quite true. Because all of us are battling between this vulnerability and shame in her way of classifying things, in my way of classifying things, we're all battling with this spirit and flesh. And when we go into the arena, we have to recognize that there may be people in the arena who are not winning the battle when it comes to spirit and flesh. And they may be winning it partially, but not winning it all the way. And so you can count on the fact that one of the things that's going to happen is you are going to get kicked in the arena by people who at the same time are telling you, why don't you behave more in the spirit? Why don't you show yourself more vulnerable? And then as soon as you do, you're going to get kicked. because that's the way flesh and spirit works. Because what the flesh will do is it will drop back in the other person and have that person of the spirit say, oh yeah, that's right. I understand. You can tell me anything that you're feeling and you can expose yourself emotionally to me. And because I really want to know. And then as soon as you do that, the flesh will reel up and go, oh, how dare they say that? You know, and bam, here it will come. So I don't think it's quite sufficient just to talk about how if we're more vulnerable, then everybody else will be more vulnerable. Or if we just somehow do away with our shame that we can get more vulnerable and we can solve everything. I think it's really important to understand tactically where people are in this continuum of flesh and spirit, and where we are in this continuum of flesh and spirit, and constantly move towards spirit, but be wise about how we do it. Now, her gender biases, as far as shame goes, absolutely spot on. Absolutely. As far as I'm concerned, her research about how shame applies itself different between the different genders, that fits perfectly with what I've been saying about the core lie that the flesh tells us. Because the core lie that the flesh tells us is different between the genders. The core lie that the flesh tells men is that women, my wife is calling on the phone, but I'm just going to let it go to voicemail and I'll get back with her because I need to finish this up. The core lie that the flesh tells men is that women exist solely for the purpose of helping them control their sperm count, i.e. for them to make progeny. And what we believe as men is that the way we win women, I'm rolling down my window because it's quite warm outside and I'm in my garage. You're going to hear my voice bouncing, but that's okay. The way we win women is by being strong, by having a lot of money, and by being attractive in terms of power. That's the lie. And so because we believe that that's our goal in life, that our goal in life is to get women, then of course we say that the important thing for men is to spend a lot of time at work, to acquire things, to get more powerful, and to be powerful, because that gets us women. On the female side of that lie is that men exist as success objects, not sex objects, success objects, that men exist to take care of me and provide for me. And so what shame says is, if you're not attractive enough, if you don't devote your resources, if you don't learn to be nice, if you don't learn to, what were the other pieces of it? Just a second. Because all of these pieces, let's see. Oop, one moment. I'm almost there. If you're not nice, if you're not thin, if you're not modest, if you don't use all your available resources on your appearance, you diminish the chance that you're going to get a guy to take care of you. It's all bound up in these core lies and these the core thrust of our lives to figure out, how do I become safe in this life? How do I survive this life and not be vulnerable? How do I be safe? And for women, the core lie is that you need a man to make you safe. And for men, the core lie is, I have to be strong to get safe. And then if I'm strong and safe, I'll get women. So I see this talk that she did about vulnerability and shame as very, very similar to flesh and spirit. And I can see where those pieces plug in. But I think if you just stop at vulnerability and shame, you really don't get the whole picture. And you really don't establish a platform that you can work from. When you recognize that there's these dual forces within you and that the flesh is always going to try to take you towards failure, I think that that gives you a much stronger platform to get some leverage against, to not listen to the flesh, than if you just say, let's all be vulnerable so that we can have more empathy for us, for each other, because that's the way we live wholeheartedly. And let's not have as much shame. There may be some people that'll go, oh yeah, okay, yeah, sure. Well, I'll try that. But just saying, you know, don't have shame, I think is weaker than saying, look, you have a voice inside you that is dedicated to your destruction, and it is going to be feeding you lies. And if you listen to those lies, all you're going to be doing is getting weaker and weaker and more on the path of failure as opposed to the path of success. Because that thing within you that's giving you those lies, that thing is not your friend. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.